In chapter 5.8, we start to discuss methods that have a faster convergence rate than kind of this steepest descent family. So first method in this now new family is the so-called conjugant gradient method. In the conjugant gradient method, you construct a so-called B-orthogonal sequence, so two sequences of vectors which are called gi and hi. So the gi's are just the gradients, but nevertheless, due to the sequence of configurations that are generated, those gradient vectors have the property shown in equation 47, namely they are orthogonal. So in this case, I mean gi is a gradient in the iteration number I, gj is a gradient iteration j, and k is a component of the vector. We have then this second sequence of vectors, which are denoted by h, and they also satisfy some kind of generalized orthogonality equation, which is shown in equation 48. So just they are not directly orthogonal to each other, but you have to sandwich kind of this matrix A in between. And the matrix A, of course, is again the Hessian matrix. So why is this sequence of HIs so useful? Well, of course, you remember when we have a quadratic form, and if we minimize it, then of course we end up with a linear Sivtsanov equation. And so it turns out that when you have this sequence of HIs, you can very easily solve a linear system of equation A of x equals y. So A, of course, in our case is a Hessian matrix, but in principle, of course, it could be another matrix if you are just interested in solving a linear system of equations. So let's now express our unknown vector x as just a linear combination of those hj's, right? So we have x equals sum over cj times hj. Well, then we plug in this ansatz for x, we plug it into this equation 49 to get the equation 50, and then we multiply from the left by hi. And then that's now in equation 51. And then if you compare with equation 48, then you see that this HIA HJ is a Kronecker delta. So in this sum, only one term is surviving. So we get only CI. And so this CI is then given by HI transposed times Y. Okay, so you see, once you have this sequence of HIs, right, then of course you can calculate the scalar product with the left-hand side, with the y, and then you have your coefficients, and if you have your coefficients, then of course, according to the line between equation 49 and 50, right, you can calculate the x, which is just, yeah, it's a sum over cj times hj. Yeah, this method is also widely discussed in mathematics. And there, I mean, one of the advantages that's pointed out in those descriptions is typically that you will find a solution of your linear system of equations with a finite number of HIs. So actually, of course, since they have to be all linearly independent, actually the number of HIs can be at most equal to the dimension of your matrix N. So if you have a 100 by 100 matrix, then when you have generated 100 of those HIs, then you necessarily know the solution. But actually that's kind of more or less irrelevant in practice for two reasons. First of all, of course, again, we have not typically a quadratic minimization problem, but more general functions. And then actually also those, if you generate this by orthogonal sequence from equation 47 and 48, then those properties that they will give a delta ij, they are lost numerically very rapidly. So that's actually also in a certain sense some kind of catastrophic loss of precision. So typically after something like 10 iterations, actually this is not satisfied anymore numerically. Of course, it would be satisfied in exact arithmetic, but it's not satisfied in a floating point arithmetic. Well, and then of course, in addition, if you have a very large matrix, I mean, if you have a function that depends on many, many variables, let's say on 1,000 variables, right, then this matrix A is a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, and then 1,000 iterations is quite a bit, and probably that's typically you would like to, of course, to find the solution with a smaller number of iterations. So the reason why, nevertheless, the conjugate gradient method is very useful in practice is that you can show, actually, that the number of iterations that's, again, needed to reach a certain precision is given now by the square root of the condition number. So that's this equation 52. So you remember, in the steepest descent case, we had that L is proportional to the condition number kappa, and now it's proportional to the square root of kappa. So that means, again, to make an example, right? I mean, if the condition number would be 10,000, then we need 10,000 steepest descent steps, but we need only of the order of 100 steps if you use a conjugate gradient method. Of course, that's a big advantage, and indeed, the conjugate gradient method typically converges much faster. Of course, in the case where the condition number is of the order of 1, then of course you see that you don't gain a lot of efficiency if you switch from the steepest descent to the conjugate gradient method. Okay, so for the moment I have just assumed that we know this B orthogonal sequence of the GIs and HIs, and now on page 69 I will just give you the equations to generate the sequence. Actually, I will give just equations without giving any proof. So in the first step, of course, you have to calculate the gradient g0 of the function. And then in the first step, you put h0 equals g0. Okay. Then we have to do again this line minimization that we have already seen previously in the context of the steepest descent. But the difference is here now, and that's this equation 53, that we do the line minimization not along the gradient vector, not along g, but along the h. Of course, in the first steps, as we have seen, they're identical, but later on, they are not identical anymore. Okay, so if I do the line minimization, of course, it's guaranteed that in every step, I will get lower in energy. So that's nice. Then I do, this update, equation 54. And again, here's the important differences. You see, you do the update not in the direction of the gradient, but in the direction of this h. Yeah, then in the next step, equation 55, you calculate the next gradient at step L plus 1. And then equation 56, you calculate now the next vector in this sequence of the h. So HL plus 1, which is given by the gradient GL plus 1 plus gamma times HL. Okay, and this gamma, now there are actually several formulas available to calculate it. The most widely used is the so-called Pollack-Ribière formula, which is given in equation 57. Actually, if you have paid well attention, then you might say, well, this equation doesn't make sense. If we go back to this equation 47, right, which is the orthogonality condition between the gradient vectors, then of course you see that in this equation 57, the scalar product between GL transposed and GL plus 1 should be 0. So you could essentially drop this minus GL. That's true. The reason why, nevertheless, this minus GL term here is added is that you can show that if you are outside of a quadratic region, then with this Pollack-Ribière formula, your directions H are point kind of more or less in the direction of the gradients, and therefore you get down. Of course, once you're in the really in a quadratic region, you can actually take out this term, but on the other hand, it doesn't really hurt you because, I mean, it just will cancel out. Okay, in chapter 5.9, let's look once more at the Newton method. And actually, I kind of discuss this Newton method here again, because in practice, frequently you will find minimization problems where the Hessian matrix is singular. And then, of course, you cannot calculate a to the minus 1. And so you directly, so you have to do it in a different way. And how to do it, that's what I want now to discuss in this chapter 5.9. Okay, so yeah, let's assume we know the Hessian matrix A at a point x, and that at that point x also we have calculated the gradient. Actually, I call it here now the force, because I mean very frequently, right, we use that for kind of a geometry relaxation, like in your previous exercise. And so what do we do then? Yeah, now actually we don't calculate the inverse of the Hessian matrix. Instead, we diagonalize the Hessian matrix. Of course, if I do that, then I will get a set of eigenvalues, lambda I, and eigenvectors vi. And there are kind of lots of very efficient kind of routines available. For instance, the most widely used library for solving problems of this type is a so-called LAPACK, linear algebra package. And there you have a routine that's called DSYEV, which will just, yes, do this calculation. So it will calculate the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of a symmetric matrix. Actually, it will then overwrite in the output this original matrix with the eigenvectors. So each column of this matrix then contains one eigenvector, and the eigenvalues and the corresponding eigenvectors are actually in increasing order. We will later on also use this method, and since I'm not sure whether you have access to this LAPACK library, I will provide you actually with a less efficient numerical method, the so-called Jacobi method, but also for our purposes that will be sufficient to solve the problem. So now when we have now the eigenvectors, we transform our force vector into this new coordinate system that's spanned by the eigenvectors of this matrix. So that means I have to project then, of course, the force on all those different eigenvectors. So that's this equation 58, right? So the sum goes over j, all the components of this vector f and vi. And yes, we do it for all the vectors vi's, all that come out of the LAPACK routine. And then we get those coefficients gi. So what's the meaning? I mean, gi is just now the expansion coefficient in this new coordinate system. Okay, now you remember we now actually just for the moment do the just standard Newton method. That means we have to apply a to the minus 1 on our gradient. But now in this new coordinate system, of course, our Hessian matrix is diagonal, right? It has on the diagonal, it has the eigenvalues, so the lambda i's. And then it's very simple for a diagonal matrix to calculate the inverse, right? The inverse matrix has just on the diagonal the elements 1 over lambda I. And therefore, I can now calculate in equation 59 those new coefficients, namely those are then the coefficients of just this vector a to the minus 1 applied on f, but in this new coordinate system. And then, okay, finally, probably, of course, I want to go back in my original coordinate system. And that I do it here in this equation 60, right? I just sum now up those new coefficients, from equation 59 times vi. Okay, and then of course I just do the standard update procedure in equation 61, right? R goes over in R plus this f with a hat on top of it, which means it's now that's essentially this preconditioned gradient. Okay, so that works fine if the matrix A is non-singular, that means if it doesn't have zero eigenvalues. But of course, you see that equation 59 is not applicable if one of the eigenvalues is zero. So what can we do in that case? Well, I mean, if we try to calculate a to the minus 1, we have a problem. But actually, if we have diagonalized the matrix, we can handle that very easily. So instead of equation 59, we use now equation 62. So that means we just add a certain constant gamma to the lambda I, and we choose this gamma such that this quantity 1 over lambda I plus gamma is always positive and not too small. Yeah, actually, that's fine. I mean, of course, if we have now an eigenvalue that's zero, then actually the force component or the force projected on this eigenvector should be more or less zero. I mean, what's the meaning of those eigenvectors that have zero eigenvalues? Actually, those eigenvectors, they describe translations and then also rotations of the system. And of course, if you calculate the force, right, then unless you have some external force acting on your system, right, then you know the force on the center of mass is zero. So that means there should be no translational component in the force. So actually, the G1 should actually be essentially zero. But numerically, of course, it's not exactly zero. It's perhaps, I don't know, 10 to the minus 15. And then the lambda I also numerically, of course, is not exactly 60, zero. It might be also something, I don't know, of the order of 10 to the minus 15. And then you see if this gamma would be zero, right? I mean, you get a quantity which is completely ill-defined. Whereas if you add now a reasonably large value of gamma, right, then the GI will be very small. And that means this now G hat will be very, very small, as it should be. Okay, then when you have calculated now by this equation 62, those coefficients GI hat, then of course you can again use in the next step equation 60 to again to transform back to your original coordinate systems. You get kind of this preconditioned force, and you do the update and you repeat that unless you have found the exact nearly exact minimum. This problem of a singular matrix, of course, is not only found in the Newton method. If you use the preconditioned steepest descent method, actually, it can also occur that the preconditioning matrix is singular. And in this case, then you have to do exactly the same procedure. So that means instead of solving a linear system of equations, right, you have to diagonalize this preconditioning matrix and then do the steps that I have explained now in that context.